Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Ron McKeefrey, and this is episode number 314. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Appreciate you, those of you that like, share, comment. Just helps us continue to highlight the great people that we have in our profession. Also want to thank our sponsor, Train Heroic, for bringing this episode to you for free. I only partner with companies that I believe in, both the people and the product, and Train Heroic is a fantastic product, but they're even better people. So if you're in the market, check them out. If not, just let me know how much you appreciate them the next time you see him at a conference or something. This week, I'm joined by Jason Lake. He's a professor in sport and exercise biomechanics at University of Chichester.
Perfect.
I'm going to mess that up. But I met Jason over at the UKSCA just a couple weeks ago and was really impressed by his presentation and wanted to get him on the podcast here. So thanks for coming on, man.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Jason, I know you spend most of your time in academics, but you know, be it either as an athlete or as a coach or as a professor, which stop along the way best developed you for your current role?
I'll be honest with you, probably the 5 years I spent in the army.
Yeah,
literally just realizing that, or getting to that point where you could do stuff. You just had to get on with it.
What do you think about the army taught you? The lessons that you take with it now?
If you keep pushing, typically you'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing, I guess, is that nothing lasts forever.
Exactly.
Whether that's good or bad.
No doubt. Well, growing up in a military family and working in special operations, I can relate with that for sure.
Yeah.
One of the questions I always ask on this podcast, I think is so important is, as coaches, as professors, we all make mistakes almost daily.
Absolutely.
What's one of the biggest mistakes you've made and how you've learned from it?
Probably sending two Kistler amplifiers back to Switzerland to be repaired when there wasn't actually anything wrong with them. And I just turned on the wrong knob. that cost a few thousand pounds to send them over for them to then send them back to tell us there was nothing wrong with them. And perhaps, and I think they even bought a bit of tape over the switch for us so we didn't do it again. Yeah, that was a little bit awkward.
Absolutely. Well, I think, so many times as coaches, we can learn from the mistakes of others and how try to avoid some of those pitfalls. I mean, I think obviously in this case, it's, fully vet out the process before you go looking for help. I think sometimes we're too quick to go look for help.
Absolutely. In my field, the amount of times we've had people spend 2-3 hours recording video footage to do some sort of video analysis of, only for them to realize that they had the lens cap on for the whole time. You'd be amazed at how many people still do that. They press play, don't check what they're recording, and then they get angry. It's like, oh, well, okay. It's just basics, isn't it? Just keep the basics covered and you normally go very far.
100%. Well, you did most of your research. I mean, you did most of your PhD work, and then your research focus is in, vertical jump.
Yeah. Mechanical demands, really. Mechanical demands of resistance exercise, but a real special sort of interest in the Olympic weightlift, but also more recently the vertical jump.
So, I mean, I think most of the people that are listening, they'll identify with that because of, vertical jump is obviously a tool or a measurement used in most getting to the next level in some capacity.
Absolutely.
So in your findings, what have you found is maybe something that people are missing when it comes to improving vertical jump?
So in terms of actually recording the data, it's typically that people don't spend enough, or don't give enough attention to detail in terms of how they standardize the way they collect their data so they can obtain consistent data. That's probably the key. You have to really sort of take, it's a dull subject often, but you have to take ownership of the process so that the data you get, you know, you can actually be confident in it.
Sure.
That would be the key for me. I think, you know, if we're starting to talk about how to improve the vertical jump, I think there's no point in even worrying about that unless we've actually collected the data properly. So I think that for me, you've got to get it back to that every single time. And it's repetitive and it's boring, but it's just one of the things. Make it a habit and it becomes easy.
Sure. We'll get into some of the ways that you've conducted, force plate testing and those lines. But what you have and what you're confident in that your data is sound, where's an area that, I mean, obviously, you know, there's the handful of coaches that'll live and die by the Olympic lifts, mm-hmm. handful of coaches that'll live and die by plyometrics. I mean, where do you think that people are maybe missing the boat and where there's an opportunity to really have a big thing with your coaching?
This is going to sound really stupid, potentially, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. Practice jumping.
Yeah.
We'd be amazed at how many times we've just had people practice jumping two or three times a week for 5 to 6 weeks and bugger me if they didn't get better.
No question.
And of course, we can start talking about dynamic strength indexes and deficits and all this sort of stuff. And if people are getting stronger and they're getting better at their jumping technique, then they'll typically be able to jump better. Okay.
Great.
It's pretty simple. Of course, once you get to a certain point, we need to perhaps, you know, think outside the box a little bit or perhaps push the margins a little bit. But typically, for the majority of people, it's all about learning how to do that jump properly, finding that technique that works for them, getting stronger.
Right.
Use that strength, get stronger, and then learn how to use it.
The greatest sprint coaches in the world will tell you that the way to get faster is to sprint.
I mean, don't run faster without it, can you?
Yeah. Sometimes we, as coaches, we want to overcomplicate things, and it really comes down to the basics. And
absolutely. Absolutely. When we talk about getting stronger, that can be, you know, you can go down your traditional road of your bilateral stuff like squats, deadlifts, etc. The Olympic weight list can be excellent for the people who are able to do them. But, you know, for some people, they don't even have to do that just yet. Because, I mean, we found that people can improve their vertical jump height. They're not very good at it in the first place by just doing kettlebell swings with a light kettlebell. So, you know, there's so many different options out there. And like you say, I do think we fall into the trap of trying to overcomplicate stuff sometimes.
You know, the presentation that you gave, which you did a fantastic job over there at UKSEA, it's so hard to kind of put so much material in a 50-minute slot. But
I'll try my best.
Talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, we've got a wide range of coaches that listen. We've got experts that have been using force plates for, you know, however many years, 10, 15 mm-hmm. years. And then we got people that have never even heard of them.
Absolutely.
What does a force plate in terms of, let's just narrow it down to the important performance enhancing in terms of maybe the squat or the vertical jump or something along those lines. What is it? What does the data, what does it give you?
So basically a force plate is just an expensive and sensitive bar from scale. It tells you how heavy you are. And because you're moving, it essentially gives you some information about how your center of mass, so the point at which the rest of your mass, the barbell and the body, is distributed around, is accelerating. So it gives you the direction and the rate of acceleration. The direction and the magnitude of acceleration. And once you know that, you understand things like Newton's laws, you can actually process or manipulate that data so you can actually calculate things like velocity, so how fast you're moving and in what direction. And then from that, you can get displacement, so how far you're moving, and again, direction. And of course, then you can get a little bit more carried away and start looking at things like power, the peak forces over different phases, et cetera, et cetera.
You mentioned earlier, you know, obviously the data is only as good as the collection method, methods. You know, what's for somebody, again, that's unfamiliar, what's the best way to go ahead and conduct that force plate test?
There's a couple of key steps. The first thing you need to do is you need to identify the technique that you want your guys to use. So what's relevant for them in their sporting area, sporting performance? Is it because you want to see how high they can jump and because they're involved in jumping sport? Or is it because you want to test some sort of physical quality, utilization of the stretch shortening cycle, how quickly they can move, whatever it is? Once you've done that, have your guys stand on the force platform, ask them to stand perfectly still and record the data, start recording data at least 1 second before you give the word of command to jump, and just watch them. So to make sure that they're actually standing still. Because if you haven't got that standing still baseline, you can't really do the rest of the processing that you need to do to get the key information from. Also, keep the instructions nice and simple. So, for example, it might be jump as fast and high as possible. Yeah. But, of course, make it relevant to what that athlete's used to.
Absolutely. You know, I think in a laboratory setting, obviously, it's a little bit more easily controlled environment than in making it an everyday part of a weight room training session or diagnostic type of source.
Excuse me.
What test, and how would you go about implementing it into a team setting, into a training session?
I think the easiest way we've seen, and again, because I don't really coach, this is from just sort of chatting with guys that I do know who do coach regularly. For those that are able to do it, who've got the kit and equipment available to them, it's normally part of the warm-up. So you have the guys do 2 to 3 jumps, get them in a bit of a round robin. Obviously, the more force plates you've got, the easier it's going to be to actually physically implement, depending on the size of your squad. You know, we know guys that have used force deck systems, for example, and they know they can have 3 to 4 or whatever sets of plates, and they can simultaneously record that data, and it will come up on the screen in front of them. Conversely, you've got Hawkins, for example, who again provide pairs of plates, but they're wireless, and you can operate them off of a tablet. So you've got pros and cons with the different systems out there. But I think implementing them into some sort of part of your warm-up immediately after your warm-up, so they just become a natural part of that routine, can work really, really well. If you're crunched for time, obviously.
Right. Yeah, I would say the same thing. I mean, either in the warm-up or, you know, as part of a rotation of sorts.
Absolutely. They're not taxing.
Right.
You know, but obviously you need to be careful. They are in some sort of rotation in some way, shape or form. You've got to be a little bit careful of what the guys are doing before they get to the jump, and obviously try and keep that at least consistent.
I was going to say, as long as that's consistent with...
Absolutely. Make it routine, yeah.
What about, you know, like obviously over there in the UK, I mean, there's not as much American football, but you have rugby. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the people that are listening to this are probably coming from a combat sport or a collision sport type of background. You know, again, I always say that the data is one thing, but the data without context is another, right? You know,
Absolutely. When
you're creating a profile for a combative athlete or a collision sport athlete, what are we talking mid thigh pull? Are we talking counter movement jump and vertical jump? Are we how are we creating a profile for that athlete?
I think if you've got the option to, I think I love the isometric mid thigh pull. I think it's simple. Obviously, you need the kit and equipment. But it's relatively simple. It's relatively non taxing. Yes, you put a maximal effort in, but it doesn't fry your CNS. It doesn't take a massive amount of recovery. And I think couple that with something like the counter movement jump, or for the guys who are a little bit more advanced, something like a drop jump, bilateral or unilateral, depending on where they're at and what their sport is. I think a combination of those two can give you so much information about their force application qualities. So how much they can apply to an isometric or during an isometric condition, how quickly they can apply it during that condition, but then also how they can actually accelerate their body mass as a consequence.
Do you think that when you talk bilateral and unilateral there, mm-hmm. with some of the plates, obviously there's dual plated force plates, you know, do you need to do both bilateral and unilateral in that setting?
If you've got the time and energy, absolutely. I would say probably the best bang for the buck for the majority of people is going to be bilateral tests.
Right.
Unless you're the guys that you're working with have got some sort of issue, some sort of history. But the best answer to all questions is surely, you know, it depends.
Yeah.
And I would say typically you're probably going to be going down a bilateral route, but occasionally and for certain populations, you'll be going down a unilateral route. Because as soon as you add the unilateral options, you've essentially got to do those jumps 3 times because you've got basically three tasks.
Right.
Bilateral, then left, then right. So it does add to the time. So it's got to be worth that time investment.
Well, I think that's the challenge, right, for strength and conditioning coaches.
Absolutely.
Especially in American.
To focus on them why, yeah.
an American system where you're limited by hours, maybe because of the league or whatever as well.
Absolutely.
When you're talking variables, I mean, you talk center of mass, talk acceleration, you talk velocity, power, peak power, you know, all these different things. You know, again, let's use that rugby athlete or that American football player athlete as a muse there. What variables do we need to be concerned with?
So if we focus on, say, the counter movement jump, I think the keys to key variables to focus on, you probably don't want to go any more than six variables, because when you do that, you get over that, it gets really complicated quickly. I think it can be useful to quantify the dip displacement, so the counter movement displacement. I think it's useful to then quantify the counter movement duration, the push off or concentric phase duration, and the average forces that are applied during both of those. Now, if you get the takeoff velocity as well, obviously you then know how quickly the guys left the ground. From that, you can then, if you want to, you can actually calculate jump height, depending on whether or not that's something of interest to you. And because you've got that takeoff velocity, if you want to, you can also then calculate things like impulse. So I think they're the sort of bare bones six variables you need. And then obviously from that, you can calculate various other bits and pieces. Of course, there's going to be people that are interested in power for some reason or another. Brilliant. That's absolutely fine. But make sure you understand why you're measuring power.
Right.
You know, power can be really useful, but in something like a counter movement jump, unless the counter movement displacement is consistent, any change in power can be purely as a consequence of dipping further or less.
We talk a little bit about, you know, whether or not, you know, it's a dual deck or it's a single deck or whatever. What are, I mean, there's lots of different products on the market right now.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there are various price points and various, you know, claims of what are the things that we need to be looking for? You don't have to give me a specific brand, but what are some things that we need to be looking for when purchasing
a force? You need something that's robustly made, because you're going to have there's scope for having some big guys applying an awful lot of force, not just during the pushing, but also you tend to forget the landing bit. And the landing bit is typically where the really large forces happen. And they happen really quickly as well. So you need something that's going to be able to withstand your athletes. You know, a Pasco force plate made out of plastic, but if you have two of those, that might be suitable for the guys you work with. On the other hand, it might fall to pieces after a few weeks. Right. It depends, right? So you need something that's robust. You've got to bear that in mind. You need something that will enable you to capture your data at least 1,000 hertz. Okay. I would tend to suggest that you avoid black box solutions, but I'm also aware of the fact that for people who are time crunched, they can be an absolute blessing. So I appreciate that as well. But ideally, if your system does work on a sort of black box type of situation, being able to access the raw data can be really, really useful, because at least then you can do your own checks and make sure you understand how that bit of software is doing what it's doing. Again, it's all part of taking ownership of those numbers.
Right. And what you mean by that is, for those that are listening, is like a system such as Sparta Science or something along those lines, where they've got their own algorithm, their own interface.
Absolutely, yeah.
As long as you can get to that raw data. If you need
it. Absolutely. Most of the systems use their own algorithms, and that's absolutely fine, because I don't think there's a, you know, I'm trying to think of the systems out there. I don't think there's one system that I would say definitely don't get.
Right.
Because I don't think there are any systems out there that are that bad that you should avoid them. But there's going to come a time where you need to perhaps get the guys to come and give you a demo, because you need to understand what they do, what's going to be involved from, you know, what's going to be required from you, what sort of level of expertise are you going to require? Is there a way that you can teach yourself how these data are calculated?
Great.
Again, comes down to that taking ownership of the numbers.
You know, I think whenever we start talking technology, there's always the opportunity here to go too far extreme, to where if you don't have HRV, you don't have these different tools, you can't.
So I think I should probably qualify by the fact that actually make sure you need a force plate. You know, if you're in the mid range, sort of, if you're in the mid price range, so you're looking at something that's going to be about 6 to 10K.
Right.
But for some, you know, for an awful lot of clubs, that's going to represent a big chunk of investment.
Right.
Do you actually need that? Is that going to help your practice or help inform your practice?
Right.
And a lot of cases, it might not be the right time to do that. So maybe hold back. Don't you know, just because other people are buying them doesn't mean to say that you absolutely have to have them.
Absolutely. I agree 100% with that. Now, given that, you know, if you're in a situation where you'd like to have one, but you don't, you know, what tools, what tests are you doing to get the same, get as much of the same information as you can?
I think if you're interested in jump height because your guys have to jump high, then you can use some of the smartphone apps like the MyJump, for example.
Yeah.
If you're reasonably technically minded, you can get, obviously you can buy a switch mat. But to be honest with you, the switch mats tend to be as expensive as the cheaper force plates, like the Pasco plates, for example. So that's probably not the best way to go. But you can buy the actual mat itself reasonably cheaply. I think they're like $40. So all you need then is the timer and the ability to actually connect the two.
Right.
If you can do that, then you've got a jump mat.
Yeah.
You know, and you can do that for a few hundred dollars tops, perhaps. You know, if you can access the because the timers tend to be the more costly element. Linear position transducers can also be pretty good. They're not perfect for jump height or testing jumping, but if that's what you've got and you stick to it and you use a consistent data collection method, that's perfect. And you can get things like, in Europe, we can get a chrono jump for about 500 euros. And that works off of a free bit of software. I think, what's the one I saw the other day? Is it Speed for Lifts, I think, maybe? That was about £300. And that's another LPT. And again, if you're reasonably technically minded, and I'm really not, you can buy the LPTs from Source, so from somebody like Celesco.
Right.
And as long as you can as long as you understand how you can interface it with a bit of data acquisition software, then you've got your system.
Right.
So it goes all the way from basically an iPhone app, $10 or whatever they are, all the way up to wherever your sort of technology and your wallet's going to take you. Also, your technological know-how and your wallet's going to take you.
You know, you work with a lot of coaches, a lot of students that go off to be coaches. Mm-hmm. And you see them coming back, or you might go out and visit them and whatnot. Being in the academic world, what's the thing that you wish to either see or, how can we improve as a strength and conditioning community as practitioners within the science?
I think in some ways we're kind of shooting ourselves in the feet by spitting out so many graduates. So straight away that does cause a problem,
right? Okay?
But there's no way around that at the moment. So what I would really like to see is that the guys that do go out and graduate actually put themselves out there, make themselves available, try as much different stuff as they possibly can. That said, it'd be really cool if they could do that without getting abused by clubs and the various other institutions that are out there. That would be brilliant. I think that's the thing that lets us down. Now I understand why it happens, and typically the guys who are behind that tend not to have an awful lot of choice, but ideally I think it'd be really, really good if we could not abuse our graduates, or we could actually, nurture the good guys that are coming out there.
Right.
Because of course it's not for everyone, and I say that as somebody who isn't a coach, for me, I think it's quite nice because I can just stand back and see what's happening, certainly with my guys anyway. And then the colleagues for other institutions as well, watching what's happening with their graduates. You know, some are doing better than the others. Why is that? Typically because they're the really keen guys who knuckle down and actually go out and try different stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that I think is just systemic of our time now, where there's this fear.
Absolutely.
Being able to go out and try whatever and without repercussion. And especially when you're in a high level sport, it's when you're dealing with millions of dollars of athletes sometimes, where it's
absolutely
a little skeptical, I understand.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's got to be that ability to be able to fail and try.
Yeah. Otherwise, how'd you learn? You only learn by getting stuff wrong, don't you?
It's the scientific process, right? I mean, it's a hypothesis and you test
exactly.
It. And you,
which is why I'm such a good scientist, because I do lots of stuff wrong. Yeah.
Right. Well, I think what I would like to see is I'd like to see us as practitioners and integrate more with our academics, the people that have time, that have that understand the process. And I always tell a story to anybody that'll listen as we're talking about these types of topics. you know, went down and I visited the Brisbane Broncos and their staff, and their staff each year would take on some PhD students, but they would conduct a research study each year with staff answering specific questions, and then they would put the poster board up in their office, and it was year after year of things that were specific to their situation, but they were contributing to the body of work. And I think we need to be more open and doing that type of stuff.
Oh,
collaboration.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of times I've talked to guys, various levels of clubs, and they've said, well, yeah, that study was great, but, you know, it didn't use, you know, it was university students.
Right.
Well, okay. So then typically that leads on to, well, how about we do something together then? Use your guys. We'll process the data. We'll put it out there anonymously. And of course, nobody ever does that. So it's like, well, come on. You can't criticize. You can't identify the problem, but not offer at least an element of a solution.
Sure.
You know, because the guys that, you know, myself and another, certainly in the UK and, well, around the world really, but certainly the guys I work with in the UK, we'd love to do that sort of stuff. We'd love to put different, you know, data from different populations out there so that we could have a really good breadth of research. I mean, ultimately, you need to collect your own data and apply it to your own population. But of course, the stuff that we, you know, the stuff that we get to do initially can provide a bit of a inspiration, I guess, or hopefully spark some ideas in others so they can start thinking about, you know, the ways that they can perhaps implement those strategies.
Agree. Well, man, we end the show with some resources here. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
Not coaching per se, but I would say take ownership. And it doesn't matter what that is. For me, that's normally take ownership of the process, you know, whether that's recording data, processing it, whatever, understand what you're doing. And if you don't understand, ask.
Yeah, that's so important right there. I mean, it sounds
absolutely
simple. It's important.
Absolutely. You'd be amazed at how many people try and bluff it out. It just doesn't work.
Agreed. What about a book, app, and website recommendation?
See, I'm a little bit biased, but I really like, I'm just looking at it now. I really like this one.
Yeah.
Only because I've was lucky enough to do a couple of chapters in it. But at the moment, I think that's a really, really good one. But I also really like the High Performance Training for Sports that came out by
David Joyce
and Lewinden, a few years ago. Well, that was brilliant. What was that, about 5-6 years ago, I think they came out, and I think that was excellent. I really, really enjoyed that. I mean, yeah, those two, I mean, there's loads, really. But I would say those two, if you're interested in collecting data or using any of the technology that's out there, those two books will give you a really good insight into what you can perhaps get from them. Most importantly, I think, what the limitations are.
Sure.
That's probably as important as the actual, you know, the positives you get from using these systems.
Great. Any apps or websites that you recommend?
Apps or websites. Do you know what? This is going to sound really dull, but I just like a notebook.
Yeah.
Just scribbling stuff down.
Yeah, I agree.
For me, I mean, there are loads of good apps out there, but singling one out, you know, no, I can't just think of a single one, no. And websites, this is going to sound, again, it's going to sound daft and perhaps sound a little bit lazy. I like trawling Twitter.
Yeah.
Not trolling, trawling with a W. because, you know, you get some really good ideas there. You get, I mean, obviously you get a lot of nonsense, but quite often from that nonsense, you'll quite often get some interesting conversation. And I think that's really useful. It's the sort of conversation you might have over a pint or whatever at a conference that you can't get anywhere else, if that makes sense. So I really like that. It doesn't always work, obviously, and it can sometimes get a bit nasty. But typically, I think I really like that.
And, you know, I would reiterate that. I wouldn't say trolling because there's plenty of that
on
as well. But that, you know, I think the social media tools, you know, they have the opportunity to connect people all around the world.
Absolutely.
And get some great information. But it could also, you know, as long as we're not eating our own and
absolutely
one another, you know.
Yeah. If you're gonna use it, don't be a dick.
Yeah, totally. That needs to be the title of the episode for right there. Well, man, I told you at the conference, I really appreciated your presentation and just getting a chance to get to know you a little bit better. And just thanks so much for putting out content and coming on the show.
absolute pleasure. I mean, what's the point of knowing stuff if you're not going to share it?
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefree.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefree's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefree in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefree can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefree. On Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefree. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.